We want a coalition that reflects fully the will of the people, democracy, freedom, and the basic needs of the population. Food, water, clean air, jobs, and overall national dignity. We are not bananas republic.
We are not a banana republic, says that Tunisian physics teacher demonstrating in Tunis. And let's understand the Jasmine Revolution. We thought we would begin today's show by taking a step back from one of the big stories in the news this week, the revolution in Tunisia, and just give some background on what's going on there and why it might matter so much. Two reasons why it might matter so much are that, first, some observers are saying this is the first real pro-democracy revolution in the modern Arab world, and it could have massive implications for regional change. Incidents of self-immolation, setting yourself on fire as a form of protest, which helped touch off this revolt, have already spread to Algeria, Mauritania, and Egypt. And second, some of the information in the U.S. State Department cables released by WikiLeaks seem to have played a role in sparking this people's revolt, though the State Department denies it. Most Americans couldn't find Tunisia on the map, let's face it, no less understand the internal politics of the place. So we thought this would be a good story to slow down on and just review. As for that map, Tunisia is a small North African country about the size of Florida, wedged between the much larger nations of Algeria and Libya on the Mediterranean Sea. It's due south of Italy. It has about 10 million people, a lot of them educated, mostly Muslim, but with a largely secular culture that encourages religious tolerance and discourages women from wearing the hijab in public. Tunisia was under French colonial rule and achieved its independence in 1957. Let's continue from there with our guests, Stephen Cook, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and Borzu Daragahi, the Los Angeles Times Beirut bureau chief. He is in Tunis. Welcome to WNYC, both of you. Thank you so much for doing this with us.
Thank you, Brian.
Pleasure.
And listeners, we'll open up the phones first for anyone from Tunisia who has or who has direct contact with Tunisia at 212-433-WNYC, or anyone with a question or comment about the Jasmine Revolution or the background of it or why it matters. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And Borzu, in Tunis, why is this being called the Jasmine Revolution? Why that nickname?
Well, we should be cautious. Jasmine is a ubiquitous plant throughout this temperate and beautiful North African Mediterranean Sea country. But honestly, the only people who seem to call it the Jasmine Revolution are exiles who live in France or abroad. I haven't heard that term on the streets here yet.
How much is the revolution about jobs, Borzu, and how much is it about democracy?
I think it's about both. It was a revolution that was sparked by not just the lack of jobs, but the sense of humiliation and degradation on the part of the ruling elite. It received the endorsement of the middle classes and even the upper middle classes and very wealthy people because of the lack of democracy here and the perceived antics and cronyism of the ruling family and its entourage.
Stephen Cook, same question for you, because I think it's so important. How much is the revolution about jobs and how much is it about democracy?
Well, I think, Brian, it's about both. There was a significant amount of economic grievance that went into these demonstrations and protests that swept the country over the course of the last month. But it wasn't just about economic demands. There was a linkage between those economic demands and a political system that was widely regarded as among the worst police states within the region, and that the Ben Ali regime and the cronies around him just had absolute disdain for the people and personal rights and political freedoms. You'll notice that in the, you know, the ultimate demonstrations at the end of last week on Friday, that people were certainly calling for Ben Ali to go, but they have a whole list of other demands. As your lead-in demonstrated, there is a mix of both economic demands and demand for political freedoms.
Stephen, to people who are saying Tunisia could become the first democracy in the modern Arab world, would that be a true statement?
We just don't know yet. It's too early to tell. This situation in Tunisia is far from over. The interim government, the unity government, is charged with organizing elections in the next 60 days. How those elections come off and who becomes the new leadership of Tunisia is extraordinarily important. Phase one was Ben Ali's departure. Phase two is now the organization of these elections. The opposition, the people in the streets, clearly want to press their demands and ensure that the remnants of Ben Ali's ruling party, and even the recognized opposition during that time, do not come into power and stay again for another quarter century. So there is a tremendous amount of hope. But at this point, the trajectory for Tunisia could be democracy, but it also could be the reconstitution of yet another dictatorship in the region.
Bourzou, there is an Arab League summit taking place today, as I'm sure you know, and I'm seeing reports that Tunisia is topic number one, which it wasn't originally planned to be, but that the leaders there, like Hosni Mubarak of Egypt and others, are only acknowledging the economic underpinnings of the revolution. I don't know if you from Tunis are following that Arab League summit or hearing any details of it yet, but do you see political circling the wagons taking place by other Arab dictators or autocrats or monarchs?
Absolutely. I think that they're terrified about what happened here. They're terrified about the role that pan-Arab satellite television played in helping the activists get their message out and in spreading the images of these protesters and the tactics to the rest of the Arab world. They're frightened. And, you know, the sort of language they use in public is that we're interested in the security and stability of the Tunisian system and the Tunisian people. That's all we care about. But what they're looking at here is an experiment that very much threatens them. As a matter of fact, you had a Libyan leader, Muammar Gaddafi, on TV a few nights ago, basically menacing the Tunisian people in an unprecedented speech in which he spoke directly to them and said, "Why didn't you just wait a few years? You know, he was on his way out anyway. Why did you do this to my friend?" Effectively, it just shows the level of concern that is.
We're getting comments on our comments pages. Listeners, you can post there at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show with questions or comments. Some good ones there, and we'll get to some of them as we go. We have one Tunisian caller right now, Yishan in Manhattan. Thank you so much for calling in. Is it Yisham?
It's Hisham, Brian. Love the show.
Thanks for calling.
It's Hisham, not Hisham.
Hisham,
anyway,
Hisham, gotcha, with an H.
Just a correction. Tunisia gained independence in 1956, not 1957.
Thank you.
And yeah, you're welcome. And also, this revolution started with the people, and very important, the Tunisian people gained their freedom, finally, from this dictator without foreign help, which is very important to say. And also, this revolution started not because of unemployment, but also lack of freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom. A lot of freedoms were denied for the Tunisian people, which is also a censorship of internet. That's one of the reasons I left Tunisia 13 years ago. And you can't say anything to this government, because if you say anything, you'll be jailed or even killed. A lot of people, thousands of people, were jailed for saying just like basic things, and they were denied freedom of speech, basically, and also there were no opposition party whatsoever in Tunisia, which also this president has a family that robbed Tunisia of billions of dollars. His wife, family, also his son-in-law, also a lot of all the entourage of his family were like very, very manipulating of the situation. They were taking the big infrastructure of Tunisia, which is like TV, also big banks, big even airplane companies. And that's what led these people I mean, the Tunisian people to protest against this regime.
Hisham, do you have an opinion about whether the WikiLeaks cables that actually had U.S. ambassadors saying a lot of the same things about the government that you just said played a role in touching this off? Do you have any observation?
I think it might be played a role, but not really, because, this dictator been in power for 23 years, and we didn't even need the WikiLeaks proof to do that. Because if you ask any Tunisian in Tunisia or outside of Tunisia, all they agree that this regime is corrupted, and this regime robbed Tunisia of billions of dollars.
So why now? So why now, Hisham? If this has been going on, Stephen, hang on. Hisham, one more question for you. Why now, if this has been going on for so long?
You know, it's been going on because people are fed up, and, you know, when everyone has an issue, and all these people wanted to protest against this regime all of a sudden, because everyone has he's been denied something from this government. Either he wasn't speaking freely, or he denied his basics rights, or he was robbed from his money, or mm-hmm. So all these things
have just come to a head. So Hisham, thank you very much for calling in. And which of our guests was trying to get in there?
I was just going to say that the WikiLeaks details themselves didn't seem to play much of a role. The only people who had access to them were a sliver of the elite, of the intelligentsia, who already knew all of the things that were in there. But the thing that did have an impact regarding WikiLeaks was the contempt dripping from those pages, the attitude of the U.S. towards Ben Ali and his family, and actually a realization on the part of some of the elite within the opposition that this guy was not America's friend, that he did not have the backing of the superpower the way they thought that he did.
That's Barzu Dargahi, the Los Angeles Times bureau chief in Tunis. Also with us, Stephen Cook, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Stephen, what?
I think that that reflects the fact that the fact that the United States really did not back Ben Ali is that Tunisia is largely a secondary ally of the United States in North Africa and the Middle East. And it makes it easier for the administration to take a step back and, in a very clear voice, support the aspirations of the Tunisian people. The question is, when you get into other countries in the region, how would the United States, countries that the United States very clearly backs, how would any American administration respond to events should they break out, similar to what we saw in Tunisia over the course of the last month? But just one question, Brian. You asked Hisham, why now? There really is no good answer to that question. Revolutions are quite rare. They're extremely hard to predict. And all of the variables need to come together at exactly the right time in order to spark off a massive popular demonstration against the leadership. And of course, Ben Ali helped. He made a series of mistakes at each critical moment of this month-long series of protests and demonstrations.
Before I drop the WikiLeaks question, this came out in the fall, that big document drop of U.S. State Department cables, which included some from the U.S. Embassy in Tunisia back to the State Department. And I'm just going to read a few excerpts from June of 2008. Whether it's cash, services, land, property, or yes, even your yacht, the president's family is rumored to covet it and reportedly gets what it wants. With real estate development booming and land prices on the rise, owning land or property in the right location can be either a windfall or a one-way ticket to expropriation. Ben Ali and his regime have lost touch with the Tunisian people. They tolerate no advice or criticism, whether domestic or international. Increasingly, they rely on the police for control and focus on preserving power. And corruption in the inner circle is growing. Even average Tunisians are now keenly aware of it. Tunisians intensely dislike, even hate, First Lady Leila Trabelsi and her family. In private, regime opponents mock her. Even those close to the government express dismay at her reported behavior. Meanwhile, anger is growing at Tunisia's high unemployment and regional inequities. As a consequence, the risks to the regime's long-term stability are increasing. all of those quotes from the WikiLeaks cables from the U.S. Embassy back to the State Department. So those cables do include, Stephen Cook, a description of pre-existing revulsion at the regime and possible instability.
I think it's abundantly clear that there were pre-existing conditions in Tunisia, as there are in many countries. There is, throughout the Middle East, significant grievances, perhaps not to the degree that you had in a small country like Tunisia, but similar types of grievances run throughout the countries of the region. Yet they have not experienced a revolution. And just to drive home the point, it's very hard to predict how these things happen and when they happen. But when they do, they happen very, very quickly. The U.S. ambassador in Tunis who wrote that was particularly prescient in suggesting that Tunisia was not as stable as many outside analysts believed. 2 months ago, people would have said, no, Ben Ali is stable. It's a terrible police state, but it's the one Arab country that works economically. It's been praised by the IMF and the World Bank. These are things that were at a very superficial kind of level. And I think the U.S. ambassador was getting at the major kind of dislocations and complaints mm-hmm. that, broadly speaking, the Tunisian people had.
Do you see a threat to the State Department in this? Because it would be an example of transparency through WikiLeaks helping to bring about democratic change? And do you think the State Department is lying when they say WikiLeaks played no role?
No, I don't think that the State Department is lying at all. I think it's very easy to overstate the power of the WikiLeaks revelations. As Bourzou said, only a small sliver of the Tunisian elite actually had access to this. And I don't believe that the vast majority of the Tunisian people, particularly those who came out into the streets over the course of the last month, needed WikiLeaks or the State Department to tell them what was going on around mm-hmm. them. It right. was abundantly clear that the Ben Ali and his wife's family were rapacious thieves, as the cable reflects. But that was not news to the Tunisian people.
So, Bourzou, in Tunis, how relevant is the culture of Tunisia to this revolution? The fact that it is relatively educated and relatively secular compared to many Arab nations, are those things relevant to why a revolution is happening here rather than in other repressive and poor Arab regimes?
I think there's a huge disparity between the education level and the middle class aspirations and values of the Tunisian people in general and the way that the regime was treating them. The regime was treating them as if they were a bunch of serfs. And meanwhile, there are people with like college degrees who are living in nuclear families in cities and sending their kids to school and worrying about the kinds of things that people in the West worry. There was a huge gulf between the way that the regime was structured to control people and the lifestyles of the people. So absolutely, I think that the culture and demographics of the Tunisian people played a very critical factor. These are people who are middle class. They have a stake in the system. They want to participate in politics. They want to participate in civil society. In other Arab countries, not so much.
Not so much. Pamela in Jersey City, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Oh, hello. Hi.
Go ahead.
Well, mine is a little less political. I lived there in Tunis in 1960 under Bourguiba. He'd just come into power. I was living with a young Tunisian student. And his family in Hammam Leaf, just outside. And I was allowed to sleep in his bed, in his bedroom with him. Everything was free, the incense, though, and no, I wasn't really aware I was in a Muslim country in a way. There were no headscarves and radicalism. But what was underlying there, and I felt it, and I've lived in Morocco too, is a very strong belief in fatalism. So that if you were poor, you were. It was Allah who said you were poor, if you were rich or if you were beautiful or strong. Or so there was a very strong acceptance. If I said I wish something, it would be like, no, that's, you know, it's not Allah's wish. So I feel that that's kept them a long time before exploding in this way now. And
but do I understand you recently went back to visit and
I
saw
did.
That change?
I saw, well, I went back in 1999, first on a press trip noticed already there was a sort of... I mean, originally I'd been at in the inaugurations of all the hotels and the tourism, and I saw it booming. And then I saw a sort of stagnation, but I also saw more radical elements and headscarves. And my boyfriend said, I'm not going to employ someone, a woman wearing a headscarf, because he's from sort of the older school. So I did go back, and I saw it sort of stagnating. And then again in 2007 I went back, and it seemed even worse.
So I'm going to leave it there. But, Pamela, thank you for all of that. So Borzo and Tunis, one of the issues, I understand, is how much to legalize the banned Islamist political party as well as a banned communist party. How much of an Islamist presence is there in Tunis or in the country as a whole?
I think it's there. I think that there are people in the I was hanging out actually today, coincidentally, in the very poor sections of the capital and outside of the capital. I think that there are people who would like to see Islam to be more a part of their lives. I think there are people who support those Islamist parties. But I got to say that far more people seem to be in the other direction, like more leftist and communist. There's a lot of support for the leftist parties here. The people I talked to said they feel like the leftists stuck around. They were tortured in prison. They were here, at least the major parties, throughout this whole time, whereas many of the Islamist leaders were forced into exile abroad and don't feel the connection to them that they do to the more leftist parties.
Do you want to weigh in on that, Stephen?
Well, I think that it's important for your listeners, Brian, to understand that this kind of one-dimensional or two-dimensional view of which we have of Middle Eastern politics, which sets Islamists against the state, is really not at all accurate. This was a broad-based movement with really no address. And as Borzo is pointing out, the left is very strong in Tunisia, but it's strong in other places throughout the region. In many ways, the left has been at the forefront of social and political change over the course of the last number of years, particularly as the regimes have cracked down ever harder on Islamist movements. But we have this tendency to really see things in terms of either the state or Islamists, and it's much more complex and nuanced than that in Tunisia as well as other parts of the region. It's clear that there are people who want more Islam in their lives, but whether the Islamist movement in Tunisia, which has been outlawed and its leaders forced into exile, can really make a decisive political impact, it remains to be seen, because there are these other competitors that have been as well organized and present.
We'll get one more caller in here. Salem, originally from Tunisia, now from Brooklyn. Salem, we have about a half a minute for you. Hi.
Okay, how are you? I just want to emphasize on the fact of the excuses that Ben Ali has used to stay in power. He has always been telling the West that he's protecting them against extremists, which do not exist. I think if the United States keeps this policy against Tunisia or any other Arab countries, that's exactly what's going to happen. They're going to have extremists on their hands.
Salem, thank you very much. So what's at stake, Borzo, for the United States in this revolution? And is this a case of the U.S. supporting the dictator because the dictator was seen as friendly to the United States, and now the potential for blowback once the people get their freedom?
You know, I just got to say that when Obama made that comment about saluting the dignity and bravery of the Tunisian people, it had such a huge impact here. People were really touched by that. I mean, you could see it when people would hear that on the television, the way they reacted. It was a very moving moment. I think that what's at stake, it's a huge thing is at stake. If this can work, if this turns into a decent democratic state that's a model for other countries, not just in North Africa or in the Arab world, but also in Africa. I saw an op-ed today from Chad talking about how this is an inspiration for all of Africa, which also has problems with democratic rule. This could be a very, very powerful thing.
Stephen, is it possible that they've looked at, dare I say it, Iraq, despite how that regime was born, as struggling toward democracy?
No, I don't think so. Tunisia is very far from Iraq, and there are few in the Arab world who see Iraq and the situation there, even as the country gropes towards stability and some semblance of a workable political system. I don't believe that the Tunisians or Iraq is a model for anybody in the region. I think, though, as Bourzou is suggesting, should the trajectory of Tunisia be one of more democracy, Tunisia, this tiny country of 10 million people, could be an inspiration for others. You already see that among activists in places like Egypt and Jordan, Algeria and Syria, who are watching this situation with a tremendous amount of enthusiasm and hoping to replicate this uprising against Ben Ali. As I said before, it's difficult to replicate these things in other countries and in different contexts. But clearly, something is afoot in the Middle East, and people are expressing their both economic and political grievances. And those Arab leaders who are meeting today are emphasizing economic issues at the expense of political issues. But as we've seen in the Tunisian situation, it is as much about political freedoms and personal freedoms as it is about having a decent life and being able to feed your children.
All right. It could be the start of something very, very big taking place in Tunisia right now. We thank our wonderful callers. Thank you, all you Tunisians who called in and others who've lived there. Stephen Cook, Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Bourzou Dorogahi, the Los Angeles Times Beirut Bureau Chief. Great job. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Brian.
It's been a pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation at our website, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And we also have a thoroughly unscientific poll question for today on our politics website. Do you think that social media can drive a political revolution? Go to itsafreecountry.org and register your response. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, the city of New York is sued or charged with widespread Medicaid fraud. Have you or a loved one been steered toward a home health aid when living in an institution would have been better? That's the charge. We'll talk about it in a minute.